From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with one of Israel's best-known peace activists and most popular novelists, Amos Oz, about the violence last week that left scores of people dead. Also today, reading the New Testament in the context of Jewish history, we talk with Bishop John Shelby Spong. He says Christians have misinterpreted the Bible by ignoring the Jewish background of its authors. Spong is the Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Orchard on Fire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week was a major setback for the Middle East peace process. Today, a summit meeting began in Washington involving Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Scores of people died last week during protests after Israel opened a new entrance to an archaeological tunnel. The entrance was in the old city of Jerusalem, near one of the holiest Muslim shrines. My guest Amos Oz is one of Israel's best-known peace activists and most popular novelists. His latest novel, Don't Call It Night, has just been published in the States. We called him yesterday to talk about his two obsessions, peace and literature. His new novel is about the marriage between a 60-year-old civil engineer and a 45-year-old teacher. They live in a small desert community in Israel where people dream about and long for faraway places. Oz lives in a desert community, and he says the desert is good for his writing.
Well, it helps me knock things into proportion. You know, I start my day every day by taking a half an hour's walk into the wilderness. And the wilderness reminds me that each time the politicians here in the Middle East speak about the rest of eternity, or forever, or never, never, the Middle Eastern never usually means something between 6 months and 30 years. The stones are laughing when politicians are speaking about eternity. So the desert is a great humbler.
Would you describe what the desert is like near your home? When you say you walk into the wilderness, describe what that walk is like.
The desert begins virtually 3 minutes' walk from my home. I cross the street, I pass the one block, and I am in the hilly, rocky, chalk and flint desert, where I can see the black goats and sometimes Bedouin shepherds, but usually nothing at all, just vast, empty spaces, totally unchanged since biblical times.
Are there any Palestinians living in your desert community, or are you near any Palestinian communities?
No, there is an Israeli Bedouin population in the area, but not a Palestinian population in this part of the Negev Desert. It had been empty for the last 1,000 years.
Do you think the fact that your community doesn't have Palestinians living in it and isn't near Palestinian communities affects the political views within the community?
Not necessarily. Israel is, the whole of Israel is about the size of the state of New Jersey. The occupied territories, or as I prefer to call them, Palestine, begin about 15 miles from here. So everything is very near, and the awareness is in every heart and on every mind, day and night. The problem is alive, and it's a part of everyone's life. The fact that in this novel, in Don't Call It Night, I put this problem in the background and not in the front has to do with the fact that I believe if life gets 100% political, then it is no life at all. And even in conflict-stricken eras and in tragic arenas, people still love and laugh and desire and envy and work and sometimes make mistakes.
How do you divide your time between writing about Israeli politics and telling stories in your fiction?
Well, when I get very angry, I write not a story and not a novel, but an article, telling my government what to do, sometimes telling my government where to go altogether, not that they listen. But when my mind is a little bit divided over anything at all, when I hear more than just one voice in me, that's when I know I'm pregnant with a novel. So I only write essays and articles for rage, not for storytelling. In fact, I have two different pens on my desk, very simple pens, you know, disposable pens, a sort of 99-cent pens, but two different pens, and I use one for my novels and stories and the other ones for what I call telling the government what to do.
How angry are you right now?
Quite angry.
Would you share your thoughts? Yeah, go ahead.
In the last few days, we have seen immense consequences of stupidity on both sides. I think the way the Netanyahu government deals with the Oslo Accords, the fact that they were trying to ignore or to postpone some of the Israeli commitments in the Oslo Accords contributed to the recent explosion. I think the tunnel in the Old City in Jerusalem was a total stupidity, an act of autism. I think the tunnel is not necessarily an insult to Muslims, but they should have been consulted about it. They live in Jerusalem. They are part of the population of Jerusalem. They could have a say. They could have been discussed, and the thing could have been agreed upon. At the same time, I think the burst of orchestrated Palestinian violence against Israelis was a grim mistake, and worse than a mistake, because the Palestinians in the past have lost everything by trying to just kill Israelis rather than convince Israelis and persuade them.
What options do you think the Palestinians had to express their anger over the way the tunnel was handled?
Well, I mean, if they went out on a very angry demonstrations or on a general strike, it would be perfectly legitimate. But to pick up the rifles supplied to them under the Oslo Accords and shooting at Israelis, this is no way to make peace.
This is the first time that Palestinian police and Israeli soldiers have actually fired at each other. Is that a potent image for Israelis and Palestinians?
Well, it certainly is a serious setback. It will be very difficult to put the peace process back on track, but it can be done and it has been to be done. You know, down the road, everybody knows that this is going to end with an historic compromise. The Israelis are here in this country. They are not going anywhere. The Palestinians are here in this country. They are not going anywhere. We cannot live together as one happy family. We must divide the country into two states. We must turn it into a two-family unit or a semi-detached home. This is the answer to the conflict. It's painful, it's frustrating, it's uneasy for both sides, but this is the only way, and it will have to be done. And I think deep down in their hearts or heart of hearts, most Israelis and most Palestinians know that in the end there will be some form of a partition. So why postpone it, and why the bloodshed, and why the maneuvers? Why can't the Israelis and the Palestinians sit down and start drawing a line on the map and calling this part of the country the home of the Israelis and that part of the country the home of the Palestinians?
Do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu is trying to back out of the peace plan or to force it to derail?
Well, his position is very strange. On the one hand, he claims openly that he's unhappy with the Oslo Accords between Israel and the Palestinians. On the other hand, he says that he's committed to those agreements. Now, you need to inject some enthusiasm into peacemaking. You can't make peace as if peace is a rape or an armed robbery. You have to present some generosity, some enthusiasm, some goodwill, some joy. And he doesn't show any of it. But then the Netanyahu government had been inflicted on Israel by the acts of terrorism last spring from some Muslim fundamentalists. Netanyahu is a result, the election of Netanyahu, the fact that he had been elected, is a direct result for a wave of unprovoked terrorism against Israeli citizens in February and March of this year. So rather than point a blaming finger at Israelis or at Palestinians, we need to sit down and get to work on a solution which deep down in our hearts we all know is unavoidable.
How important do you think the tunnel actually is? And maybe you could describe the tunnel for us.
The tunnel actually is an ancient water tunnel, hewn in a rock underneath the surface of the old city in Jerusalem for a water supply thousands of years ago. In itself, it has no, I believe, no religious significance for anyone. It's a part of an ancient water supply system. But it's very close to the holy places, both the Muslim holy places and the Jewish holy places. It links the Wailing Wall, which is the holiest place for the Jews, with the Via Dolorosa, which is a very sacred place for the Christians. And it's very close to the Mount of Temple, which is very sacred for Muslim and for Muslims and for Jews. So it's the location of the tunnel rather than the tunnel itself that evokes sensibilities on all sides and sensitivities.
Have you been there? Have you either been to the tunnel or have you spent time on the Temple Mount, which is also known as Haram al-Sharif, the plateau that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is built on? This is a very holy place.
I have been there many times. Mm-hmm. Not very recently, but I have been there many times, and I have seen that tunnel about 2 years ago, before it was opened to the public and before the recent opening of the far end of the tunnel. It was a one-way tunnel until a few days ago.
I wonder what it's like to be there and to if you can feel how old the area is and feel its kind of spiritual, symbolic value for Jews and Muslims.
Yes, I can see that it is immensely significant for many Jews. I can see how significant it is for many Muslims. It is not extremely significant for me personally because my Jewishness relies and relates to books and to texts and to spirituality rather than to holy stones. And my kind of Judaism has no particular leaning toward a sacred location. But I can see how important, how significant, how crucial it is in the minds of many believers.
My guest is Amos Oz, one of Israel's best-known peace activists and novelists. His new novel is called Don't Call It Night. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Israeli novelist and peace activist Amos Oz. Do you find yourself wondering what might have happened if Yitzhak Rabin had not been assassinated?
Very often. I think if Yitzhak Rabin would not have been assassinated, and if the Muslim fundamentalists would not have blown up those three buses in Israeli cities, the peace process would have made a considerable progress by now, and we would be sitting and dealing now with the terms of the comprehensive settlement. We could have been almost there now, way ahead, at least way ahead of where we are at the moment.
Where were you when you found out about the assassination?
In New York City. I arrived in New York a day before the assassination, which is why I could not attend that particular rally where Rabin was assassinated. I was asked to be one of the speakers at this rally, but I left for New York a day earlier, and of course my world and my life changed. And when I heard about the assassination, my first response was the dread and shock, because my daughter and my son-in-law and my grandchildren were there at the assembly. So you can imagine, I felt the bullets were actually fired at all of us, at the peace movement, at myself, at my family.
Did you know Rabin well?
I knew him quite well, yes.
So you missed him on a personal level too?
I miss him both on a personal level and on a political level. He was a very brave man. He was a man who changed very late in life and changed radically. people do not normally change in the late 60s. He did. And he adopted positions about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which he himself opposed and condemned for many years. I admired this change of heart and change of mind in Rabin.
What do you think was the turning point in his change?
Well, I think during the Intifada, he gradually understood that there is no question of territories. It's a question of human beings. And we Israelis cannot simply control the lives of more than 2 million Palestinians forever. They don't want to become Israelis. We do not want to force them to become Israelis. We need a fair divorce, not a honeymoon, but a fair divorce. This, I believe, Rabin and Peres, both of them, realized during the years of the Intifada.
What are your fears and hopes right now?
Well, my fears and my hopes focus around the same point. There is no alternative at the moment to the Oslo Accords, to the one and only Israeli-Palestinian agreement ever to have been signed in history. My deepest fear is that this agreement will collapse and then we will be back in square one, in a state of a total and fierce conflict between the two nations, the Israelis and the Palestinians, and possibly between Israel and much of the Arab world once again. This is my worst fear. My greatest hope is that the Oslo Accord can be put back on track and even speeded up. I think it can be done, and my ultimate hope is that the land which we call Israel and they call Palestine will be peacefully divided, and that the Israelis and the Palestinians will become decent neighbors, not necessarily one happy family, but decent neighbors in coexistence, in economical collaboration, in friendliness, not necessarily in love.
What kind of role do you think the United States can play in U.S. diplomacy?
Well, I think the United States in particular and the outside world in general should attend promptly to the sufferings of the Palestinian refugees in the refugee camps. The heart of the problem is not the holy places in Jerusalem. The heart of the problem is that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are still living in degrading conditions in refugee camps which were created back in 1948. Those people ought to be provided with homes and jobs. We are not talking about the Soviet Union. We are not talking about India or Africa. We are talking a few hundred thousand people. It's not beyond the means of the international community, of the rich Arab nations, of the European community, of the United States, and indeed of Israel, to do something and promptly to give those people some hope for the future.
Meanwhile, within Israel, there's a movement among Orthodox Jews to apply Jewish law to government law. In other words, to close all shops on the Sabbath, which is Saturday. And what are some of the other things that go along with that?
Well, that some of the Orthodox Jews would like for Israel to become a rabbinical state, dominated and controlled by rabbis in accordance to religious law, is a dream, because the vast majority of the Israeli Jews, about 80% of them, are secular. And it's not likely to happen. Of course, the Orthodox parties have been using the diversity between left and right and their own position, namely the position of the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox parties, as the balance between left and right, to influence legislation and to block some liberal and secular legislation. This is a long process. I don't think Israel can resolve this church and state issue, or in our case, synagogue and state issue, within a year or a decade. We don't want to fight a civil war of Jews against other Jews. We will have to compromise for a long time and leave the question uneasily opened for generations.
Could you live in a rabbinical state?
I don't think so. I don't think this is feasible. I don't think a rabbinical state could really exist. It contradicts itself. It has to do with the coming of the Messiah, and it has to do with very many messianic Jewish concepts. So it's highly unlikely that a rabbinical state could exist or
Do you think there are... You go ahead.
I mean, the whole thing, the whole idea of a rabbinical state is highly hypothetical, simply because 8 out of 10 Israelis are secular and would reject such an idea.
Do you think there are any parallels between Muslim fundamentalism and the movement to make Israel a rabbinical state?
There are parallels between religious fanatics everywhere, in Christianity, in Islam, and in Judaism. Fanatics of all religions believe in instant redemption and in simple formula and in installing some divine law upon earth. All of those people tend to be uncompromising. How uncompromising, this varies from one group of extremists to another. Not every Orthodox Jew is an extremist. Not every Orthodox Jew is a fanatic. But we have our share. We are not immune to this universal disease of religious fanatism and fundamentalism. The United States is not immune. The Arab world is not immune, and Israel is not immune.
So tell me, are you writing today, and which pen will you write with?
Well, I have been working this morning with my essayistic pen on an article telling the government where I think it had gone very wrong. And yet, last night, I've been working with my other pen, adding maybe a sentence and a half to a piece of prose, a stubborn piece of prose. This is a very slow work. I am lamenting over punctuation. Replacing a faulty adjective, rather like an old-fashioned watchmaker, you know, with a magnifying glass in my eye and a pair of scissors moving an adverb from one part of the sentence to another. This is the kind of work I do at night or early in the morning.
You know, you were telling us before about how you start every day with a half-hour walk in the desert. Do you do a lot of thinking about what you're writing while you're taking that walk?
Yes, in fact, I do my dialogues in my head. Sometimes I do them loud out there in the desert. No one can hear me. I need to hear the dialogues, so I speak out loud. And I imitate the voices. I try to assume different voices. It's a very funny practice. Can you think of a writer walking all by himself in the middle of the wilderness, talking in funny voices, arguing with himself?
Well, someone might think you were having visions.
You know, in this business of prophecy, there is so much competition in this particular country that I would not even dream of going into this line of business.
Amos Oz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Perry. Thank you very much.
Amos Oz spoke to us from his home in Israel. His latest novel has just been published in the U.S. It's called Don't Call It Night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, reinterpreting the New Testament in the context of ancient Jewish history and tradition. We talk with Bishop John Shelby Spong. We'll also discuss his work as Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey. And Maureen Carrigan reviews the new novel, The Orchard on Fire. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bishop John Shelby Spong is no stranger to controversy. He's the author of Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism, as well as books Rethinking the Church's Stand on Sexuality and the Treatment of Women. He has also ordained a gay minister. Spong is the Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey. Now he's reinterpreting the New Testament, putting it in the context of ancient Jewish history. He argues that the only way to understand the New Testament is to understand Jewish history, culture, and literature, because the Gospels were written by people who were of Jewish descent, and the Jewish people did not relate to sacred texts as literal truth. Bishop Spong's new book is called Liberating the Gospels, Reading the Bible with Jewish Eyes.
The content of the Gospels is so overwhelmingly Jewish once you begin to understand it that it really just almost bowls you over. It starts in the birth stories where Matthew, for example, says that when Jesus was born, a wicked king named Herod went down to Bethlehem and killed all the Jewish male babies trying to get rid of the promised Messiah. That's nothing but a Moses story because the Pharaoh went down to Egypt and tried to kill all the Jewish male babies in Egypt many, many years before in order to get rid of the one who was to be the promised deliverer. The story of the wise men in Matthew's gospel is directly related to Isaiah 60, where kings come to the brightness of God's rising. They come on camels and they bring gold and frankincense. It's hard not to see that as the background for the wise men story. The swaddling clothes that we read about in Luke's birth story is directly taken out of the book of the Wisdom of Solomon, where Israel's most resplendent king says, "When I was born, I was carefully swaddled, for that's the only way a king can come to his people." So these stories are interpretive stories. They're not literal stories. And only Jewish people who would know that Jewish background could understand that interpretation, and Gentiles who were ignorant of that Jewish background kept assuming that these narratives were to be understood as literal history.
What is the Jewish interpretive background that you're referring to? This relates to something you say in your book, that the Bible was written in the Middle East, but we've imposed a Western mentality on interpreting it.
Yes, the Jewish writers, even in the Hebrew Scriptures, wrote in what I call this Midrashic style, that is, repeating the stories of the past about a hero living in the present. The best illustration of that, in my opinion, is the story of the Red Sea. I don't know what happened at the Red Sea, and neither, I think, does the Bible, because the story of the Red Sea splitting open and the Jews walking through on dry land was not written for some 300 years after Moses' death, so it clearly grew in that period of 300 years. But in any event, that experience stands at the very heart of the Jewish experience, and in some sense was the moment when they became aware of themselves as a national people and assumed that they were God's elect, God's power to split the waters and to allow them to escape into freedom. But Moses died, and the people began to wonder if the God of Moses was still with them after Moses' death, and the way they addressed that was that they retold the Moses story about Joshua. Joshua goes up to the Jordan River. He can't get across. It's in full flood. And so God orders Joshua to step into the waters, and the waters of the Jordan River split, and Israel walks through on dry land. That's clearly a Moses story now being told about Joshua. Now, Jesus' baptism story, in my opinion, is nothing but another Red Sea story. But the Jewish people who were writing the baptism story had come to some assumption that Jesus was a greater presence of God even than Moses, so they had to heighten the Moses story. So when Jesus steps into the Jordan River at his baptism, he doesn't split the river, because anybody can do that. That's already been done 4 times in Hebrew history. Jesus splits the heavens, and the heavenly waters in the form of Spirit rain down upon him, and a heavenly voice declares him to be the Son of God. And that's the Jewish way of writing sacred stories, and it is all through the New Testament. But Christians, because we basically have been not only Gentiles, but we've been anti-Semitic throughout 2,000 years of history. We've devalued everything Jewish. We've even portrayed Jesus as if he's a Northern European and not a Jewish person at all. We Christians have simply not been aware of that background, and so our eyes have been blinded to the very depth dimensions of our own gospel tradition.
In your going back to the Bible and thinking of it as a text written by Jewish authors, you say that we've really been asking the wrong question about the Bible. Everybody asks, did this story really happen? And you think that's not the right question. Before we get to what you think the right question is to ask, let me ask you this. You say all the answers to the question, did this really happen, are unsatisfactory. What do you mean by that?
Well, the only way you can answer that question is with a yes or a no. That's the biggest problem. And if you say, yes, this really happened, that binds you into being a kind of right-wing biblical fundamentalist. If you say no, it sort of says that you don't see any great value in the scriptures, and you take the first step toward what religious people call the slippery slope that slides into making you no longer a part of the religious community. And both of these traditions are very alive today. The two fastest growing groups in the organized church today are the fundamentalist swing to the right, where they are sort of screaming defiantly, yes, it really happened, just like the Bible says. I saw a bumper sticker in North Carolina once that said, God wrote it, I believe it, that does it. That sort of puts an end to any discussion on the matter. But the other fast-growing movement in Christianity is what I call the dropout from the church, or joining what I call the Church Alumni Association. And that's happening every day. So the yes and no answer to the question, did it really happen? Did Jesus really walk on the water? Did he really feed 5,000 people? Does a virgin really have a baby? Those become questions that are almost nonsensical to modern people. And a yes and no answer, I think, is a totally unsatisfactory answer.
So what question do you think we should ask when reading the Bible?
Well, I think the question that the interpreters, the Jewish interpreters of the scriptures were trying to ask is, what does it mean? What does it mean when we assert that the birth of Jesus is a birth from God? What does it mean when we suggest in these narratives that people from all over the world came to worship this Christ when he was born? What does it mean that Jesus is portrayed in the feeding of the 5,000 as a new Moses? Moses gave manna in the wilderness. Jesus is able to repeat the Mosaic miracle. What does it mean when the story of Jesus' ascension is told? And it's really nothing except an Elijah story writ large. Elijah also ascended into heaven, but he had to have the assistance of fiery chariots drawn by fiery horses. Jesus is able to ascend in his own power because he's greater than Elijah. Elijah, when he ascends, pours out a double portion of his enormous but still human spirit upon his single disciple. Jesus, when he ascends, is portrayed as pouring out the infinite power of God's Holy Spirit upon the whole gathered Christian community, and it would abide with them throughout all the ages. It was an attempt to see Jesus in terms of these Old Testament or Jewish patterns, but raised to the nth power because human language found it very difficult to find a vocabulary big enough to translate the experience these people had with a person named Jesus of Nazareth. I think that's a totally different question.
You're arguing that we shouldn't read the Bible literally. You were brought up as a fundamentalist.
Yes.
And you even wrote a book called Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism. Did you read the Bible literally as a young man?
Oh, absolutely. You know, my family, my mother, I was raised actually as an Episcopalian, but my mother was really a very conservative Presbyterian who joined the Episcopal Church only to accommodate my father, who never attended, but mother thought if she joined, maybe he would attend more, but he never attended. So we were taken to a local Episcopal church in Charlotte, North Carolina, but it was a very evangelical fundamentalist church, and the primary influence in our home was from my very conservative Presbyterian mother, who had not really changed her Calvinistic stripes despite her confirmation. So I was raised thinking that every word of the Scripture was written by God in some way and was therefore inerrant or infallible. That created an enormous crisis for me when I grew into being an educated young man. That crisis came early. It came in high school. It didn't come in college. When I went to the university, my major was in philosophy, and I was roaming all over the world of academic thought. And my minor was in zoology, so I was confronting the Darwinian challenge to the literalness of the scriptures. And it was a very interesting time. Frankly, what most people do at that point is they reject their religious upbringing. I only rejected the literalness of my religious upbringing and began a journey into the wonder and meaning of the reality of God, which I think is still the absolute sustaining power of my life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bishop John Shelby Spong, and he's the Episcopal Bishop of Newark, author of the new book, Liberating the Gospels, Reading the Bible with Jewish Eyes. Bishop, let's take a short break.
Okay.
And then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Back with Bishop John Spong, Episcopal Bishop of Newark and author of the new book, Liberating the Gospels, Reading the Bible with Jewish Eyes. Well, let me ask you about one of your most controversial actions as the Episcopal Bishop of Newark. You ordained a gay man shortly after the Episcopal Church said that it was okay to ordain non-celibate homosexuals. Who was the man and why did you choose him to be the first?
The first homosexual person that I ordained knowingly was a man named Robert Williams. And this came after I had written a book called Living in Sin on the whole gay issue, as well as some other patterns in human sexual life that I think we need to look at and reassess from a different perspective than the traditional one. And Robert Williams was a brilliant graduate of the Episcopal Theological Seminary in Cambridge, which is part of the Harvard complex. He wrote and said, "If you really believe what you have written in that book, I wish you would test it on me." And so I invited him to come down to the Diocese of Newark and to be interviewed. And then I ordained him to the diaconate. That was in June of 1989. There was absolutely no controversy about that. A full-page story on the second front of the New York Times showed what Robert was doing. We had opened a ministry to gay and lesbian people out of Hoboken, New Jersey, which has a very strong and very large homosexual population. And he began to work among these people, most of whom are deeply alienated from the church because the only message they've ever heard from the church is that God hates homosexual people and that they ought to either be converted to being heterosexuals or be thrown out of the church or even executed, as the book of Leviticus says.
We
wound up ordaining him to the priesthood in 1989 in December, and for some reason the religious right, led by the Bishop of Fort Worth, Texas, decided to make that a cause celebre, and so they went to the newspapers and they called press conferences and they condemned this action, and they lifted Robert Williams and the Diocese of Newark into an enormous amount of national controversy.
Now, you ended up having to ask for his resignation.
Yes.
After he said, what, bad things about monogamy?
Well, that was one of the things. Robert Williams became, because of the publicity that surrounded his ordination, he became a media star almost immediately, and he was not very well equipped by either background or experience to handle the pressures. And he went to Detroit, and he was in a press conference, and he was being badgered by a very hostile reporter, and he blew his cool and began to say things that made his ministry in the Diocese of Newark, we were right far out on a line to support him, almost impossible to defend. He said that monogamy was a heterosexual practice and should never be imposed upon homosexual people. He went on to say that everybody would profit with sexual activity, and then the reporter said, "You mean to tell me that even Mother Teresa would be better off if she had a sexual experience?" And Robert said, I don't know whether I ought to say exactly what Robert said on the radio, but Robert allowed us how Mother Teresa would be better off if she engaged in sexual activity. Well, that just blew headlines across the country. Now, he had been ordained to open a ministry to gay and lesbian people in the Diocese of Newark so that we could hold up to the gay and lesbian population the model of a faithful, committed, lifetime partnership. Robert represented himself as living in that. I had met his partner, and they had been together for something like 4 years. And that was the basis upon which he was ordained. And then he began to say that he did not think faithfulness to a partner was a virtue that homosexual people ought to be held to, and that he began to prescribe sexual activity sort of random or promiscuous. And there is no way that I as a bishop or our diocese was prepared to support promiscuous sexual activity on anybody's part, whether it's homosexual or heterosexual.
What was it like for you to go out on a limb to ordain a gay priest and then have to ask for his resignation? Were you embarrassed? Did you think you had made a mistake or had made a bad choice?
No, I don't think I've made a mistake on that yet. I think both decisions were appropriate decisions, and I believe I would do both of them over again. Robert Williams taught me far more about the meaning of homosexual persons and the value that they have to bring to the life of the church than he ever hurt me. And I honor him. Robert died of AIDS about 2 years after I ordained him, which was another piece of our life, because Robert had indicated in the interview that he was not that he was in complete health, and he was clearly HIV positive and headed toward his soon-to-be death. So that Robert, for me, was symbolic of the fact that gay and lesbian people have been so abused by the church, and yet despite that abuse, they still yearn to be part of it, and they will do almost anything to become part of it. And Robert opened the door to enormous numbers of gay and lesbian people to find their way back into the church that will be an accepting community. And we today have a significant number of gay and lesbian priests serving the Diocese of Newark with incredible distinction. The most recent one that's been involved in the controversy was Barry Stopfel, who was ordained priest by me but ordained deacon by Bishop Ryder. And some bishops of the church tried to put Bishop Ryder on trial for heresy for ordaining him to the diaconate. They did not seem to want to put me on trial for heresy for ordaining him to the priesthood, though I would have welcomed that opportunity to defend that point of view.
Now, I believe you oversaw or initiated a church study on how changing ideas and changing sexual practices should affect the church. Could you sum up some of the things that you found in that study?
Sure. That was done in the Diocese of Newark in 1986 and 1987, and it was a profoundly shaping experience for the whole of the Episcopal Church and maybe even for the whole of Christendom. What we did was to begin to study changing patterns in family life. It was a rather innocuous beginning. But in this changing patterns of family life, we began to be aware that a vast majority of our young people today do not wait until they are married to initiate their sexual activity. That's just a fact. People might like it or dislike it, but it's just a fact. Another aspect of life that we wanted to look at was, what do you do with post-married people? By that I mean people who are divorced or people who are widowed. Are they supposed to either remain sexually celibate or to immediately get married again so that they can have a legitimate partner with which they can exercise their sexual lives? And then we looked at the gay and lesbian population that, under the laws of the states of the United States of America and every country of the world, are not given the privilege of a legal relationship. And we raised questions about that. I think the first issue was that I became aware that sex inside marriage is not always holy. Rape takes place inside marriage. Sexual abuse takes place inside marriage. It is not marriage that makes sexual activity holy. It's the quality of the relationship. So if sex inside marriage is not always holy, we had to face the question that sex outside marriage might not always be sinful. We began by looking at the young people. When you go back to the Middle Ages, when the standards of the church were proclaimed that sex was to be exercised only inside the marital relationship, people in at puberty in that era, at ages 15, 16, and 17, they didn't live much past 30 or 40. They tended to get married within a year or a year and a half of puberty. We don't live in that kind of world. Through better diet and many other things, we have run the age of puberty back to 11, 12, and 13 because we honor women with the understanding that they are equal and that they have brains that are capable of being educated. University-educated women like you, Terry, are a 20th-century phenomenon in the Western world. There were very few university-educated women before the turn of the century. But because of that, we've pushed the age of marriage for women into the mid-20s, so that we've created a 10 to 15 year gap between puberty and marriage in this society. And we've not bothered to recognize that the standard of the Middle Ages was applied in a world where there might be a 1 to 2 year gap between puberty and marriage and a whole different set of circumstances. Now, I don't know anybody that's suggesting that people ought to get married at age 13 and 14 so that they can be sexually celibate until they're married. But that's the reality that we're dealing with. Now, the only way you can keep people sexually celibate, it seems to me, for 10 to 15 years after puberty is to impose upon the activity of sex enormous controls like guilt and fear. And that's exactly what the Christian church has done through the years. And I do not think that that is loving, and I do not think that that's an appropriate way to proclaim the fullness of life for God's people.
Oh, one last question for you. Roman Catholic priests are prohibited to engage in sexual relations or to be married. As an Episcopal priest, you're married. You've been intimate. Do you feel that that helps you in your understanding of the people who you serve?
Well, I think I would say yes, though I've certainly known some single priests who were equally as sensitive and loving in their ability to deal with marital problems. My biggest disagreement with the prohibition against marriage in my sister communion is that I think it basically is an insult to women, because deep down it says that women are polluters and corruptors of holy people, and if you want to be holy, you cannot be in a relationship with a woman. I would deny that. If I have any chance of being a holy person, it's because I live in the sustaining love of my wonderful wife. And holiness and wholeness are the same word in the English language. And I would say that married love is an enormous asset toward creating wholeness in both partners if the love that binds those two people together is significant. And I covet that for every human being.
Bishop Spong, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Derry.
John Shelby Spong is the Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey. His new book is called Liberating the Gospels, Reading the Bible with Jewish Eyes. Coming up, book critic Maureen Carrigan has a new novel to recommend. This is Fresh Air. Scottish writer Sheena McKay has published 8 novels and 1 short story collection. Though her work has been acclaimed in Britain, she's not well known here. But book critic Maureen Carrigan predicts that McKay's new novel, The Orchard on Fire, may change that. It's just been shortlisted for England's prestigious Booker Prize.
It occurred to me the other day as I was practicing my stress-reducing deep breathing exercises that reading certain authors also produces a naturally soothing effect. Barbara Pym, James Herriot, Angela Thurkel, I just have to think of their English villages populated by vicars and scatterbrained housewives eternally shopping for a nice joint of beef, and I feel, relaxed. Their novels, however, have worn somewhat threadbare over years of rereading, so I'm always on the lookout for new additions to their cozy ranks. Sheena McKay's new book seemed just the ticket. Set in the fictional English village of Stonebridge in 1953, it focuses on the intense friendship of 2 8-year-old girls, quaintly named April and Ruby. Images of jumble sales and parish fates danced through my head, and I was deeply breathing in imaginary lavender-scented air until something rather unpleasant wafted through. For while McKay conjures up a world every bit as charming as a Ralph Lauren ad, she also acknowledges the common nastiness as well as the graver sins that infest even the most innocent-looking hamlets. Like Agatha Christie, whose manor house libraries always contained a body, McKay's nostalgic view of merry old England is speckled with mildew, which makes it less picturesque but ultimately more realistic. We first meet April in the present as a divorced, lonely, middle-aged woman who ruefully confesses that Dustbin Day is possibly more of an event for me than it might be for some. On a whim, April decides to revisit Stonebridge, the village she left decades ago. faster than you can say steak and kidney pie, the novel then transports us back to the 1950s and to the Copper Kettle Tea Room, the spectacularly unsuccessful establishment April's parents run in Stonebridge. April's best friend Ruby is the daughter of the local pub owners, and together the two girls form a secret society whose headquarters is an abandoned railroad boxcar set in the midst of an idyllic orchard. Soon it becomes clear why the two girls have a stronger than usual desire to create a hideaway. Ruby sports unexplained bruises and a black eye, courtesy of her parents. For April, evil appears in the form of Mr. Greenidge, one of the Copper Kettle's few regular customers. A melancholy gentleman married to an invalid, Greenidge plays on April's pity and good manners to regularly lure her into his house, where he professes his love while feeling her up. McKay here displays a keen awareness of the rhythms of a child's misery. April's abuse in the sweaty hands of Mr. Greenidge doesn't overwhelm her daily life. It's only, say, when she spots him strolling down High Street that her heart sinks. McKay also deftly manages to transplant the topical issue of child abuse into the halcyon world of the 1950s without damaging the atmospheric integrity of her novel. Silence reigns, and so April and Ruby never confide their shame, even to each other. The adults are just as reticent when it comes to anything dirty. Appropriately, in the tumultuous climax of this tongue-tied story, when accusations are made, they're the wrong ones, the ones people feel more comfortable uttering. Sheena McKay's new book is marred, but only slightly, by a hokey ending in which the adult April visits the village cemetery and discovers a surprise grave. Oh, for those conscientious manuscript editors of yore who would have slashed that last scene out. I'm afraid they've disappeared along with the likes of Gentlewomen and Cream Teas. But as McKay evocatively reminds us, there are some aspects of times past we needn't mourn.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Joan Tui Westman. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.